then took a second one. Larimar will never know, he thought. It's all the fault of that big dolt who knocked my teeth out. Madraman felt the hole in the front of his mouth with his tongue. He had learned to compensate for it, and didn't think about his missing teeth much anymore, though it had hurt when he was younger and women ignored him because of it. He'd since discovered that certain women were interested in him when they learned he was part of the Zelindania, even just an acolyte in training. None of those women would want him now. He flushed at the thought of his disgrace and opened the second water bag full of Barma. Why did Jondalar have to come back? He said to himself. If Jondalar hadn't returned from his journey and brought that foreign woman here, she wouldn't have found that sack. Then the Zelindania never would have known. I don't care what that fat old woman says. I don't really want to go back to the fifth cave now, and I don't want to learn another trade. Why should I? I'm as good a Zelindani as any of them, and I doubt that they've all been called either. I'll bet a lot of them fake it. What is a call, anyway? They probably all fake it, even that flathead lover. So what if she lost a baby? Women lose babies all the time. What's so special about that? He took another drink, glanced over at Brukhaval's place, then got up and walked over. Everything was there, neatly in order, the way he always kept it. He didn't even come and get his gear, Madraman thought. He's going to sleep cold tonight without a sleeping roll. I wonder if I could find him. He might be grateful if I brought him his things. Madraman walked back to his place and looked at the paraphernalia he had acquired as an acolyte. That fat old woman wants me to give it all back. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to pack up all my things and leave. He paused, looked over at Brukhaval's sleeping place. If I can find him, maybe we could go on a journey together or something, find some other people. I could tell them I am a Zelindani. They'd never know. That's what I'll do. I'll pack up Brukhaval's gear and go look for him. I know a few places he might be. He would be someone to stay with, and he's a better hunter than I am. I haven't done it in so long. Maybe I'll take some of Larimar's things, too. He'll never miss them. He won't even know who took them. It could be anyone in this lodge. They all know he won't be back. And it's all Jondalar's fault. First he nearly kills me. Then he nearly kills Larimar. He'll get away with it, too, just like he did before. I hate Jondalar. I've always hated Jondalar. Someone ought to hold him down and beat him up, ruin his pretty face. See how he likes it. I'd like to give Ayla a few whacks, too. I know a few people who wouldn't mind holding her down. I'd give her something else, too, like a load of my essence, he thought with an evil grin. Then she wouldn't walk so high. She never would share pleasures with anyone else, not even at mother festivals. Think she's so perfect, finding my sack and bringing it to the Zelindania. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be out. I'd be Zelindani. I hate that woman. Madraman finished up the second water bag of Barma, grabbed several more, then looked around to see what else he wanted to take. He found a spare outfit, used, but still good. He tried it on. They were nearly the same size. He took it. His Zelindania clothing was decorative and distinctive, but not very practical for long hikes. The sleeping roll wasn't much good. It was an old throwaway to begin with. Larimar's good one was in his mate's tent. But there were several other very nice items, including a good fur cover. Then he found a real treasure, a new full winter outfit that Larimar had recently traded for. His Barma was constantly in demand, and he had always been able to trade for whatever he wanted. Next, Madraman walked over to Brukhaval's place and began hauling everything he saw back to his own place. He changed into the more practical outfit that he'd found at Larimar's place. It didn't matter that it had ninth cave decorations instead of fifth cave. He wasn't going to be staying at either place. He took food from both places and then rummaged through the possessions of all the rest of the men, taking food and a few other items as well. He found a good, well-hafted knife, a small stone hatchet, a new pair of warm mittens someone had just acquired. He didn't have any with him, and winter was coming. Who knows where I'll be then, he thought. He had to repack a few times, eliminate a few things, but once he was ready, he was eager to leave. He put his head out of the lodge and looked around. The campsite was full of people as usual, but none were nearby. He hoisted on the heavy back frame and started out briskly. He planned on heading generally north, the direction he had seen Brookeval take. He was nearly beyond the boundary of the summer meeting campsite, close to the camp of the ninth cave, when Ayla came out of a dwelling. She seemed to be distracted, preoccupied, but she glanced up and saw him. He flashed her a look of sheer hatred and kept on going. The camp of the ninth cave looked deserted. Everyone had gone to the Lanzadani camp for a joint midday meal, a feast they had been planning together for some time. But Ayla said she wasn't hungry and promised she'd come later. She was sitting on her bedroll in the dwelling, feeling despondent, thinking about Brookeval and his outburst at the meeting, and wondering if there was anything she could have done. She didn't think Zelandani had anticipated his reaction, and it didn't even occur to her to consider it, though now she was sure she should have. She knew how sensitive he was to inferences that he was in any way related to Flatheads. He called them animals, she thought, but they aren't. Why do some people always say that? She wondered if Brookeval would still feel that way if he knew them better. It probably wouldn't make any difference. A lot of the Zelandani feel that way. The first reminded everyone that Brookeval's grandmother had not been in her right mind when she found her way home again, and that she was pregnant. Everyone says she was with the clan, Ayla thought, and they're right. It's obvious that Brookeval has some clan mixture in him, so she must have become pregnant while she was with them. That means some clan man had to put his essence inside her. A thought Ayla hadn't considered suddenly came to her. Did some man of the clan force her over and over again, the way I was forced by Braud? I wasn't in my right mind when Braud was doing that to me, and I didn't think they were animals. I was raised by them. I loved them. Not Braud. I hated him, even before he forced me. But I loved most of them. Ayla hadn't thought of it quite that way when she first heard the story, but it was a possibility. The man might have forced her out of meanness, like Braud, or he might have thought he was doing her a favor, taking her as a second woman, perhaps, accepting her into the clan, but it wouldn't have made any difference to her. That's not how she would have seen it, Ayla thought. She couldn't talk to them or understand them. They were animals to her. Brookeval's grandmother must have hated it worse than I hated Braud doing it. And as much as I wanted to have the baby when Issa told me I was pregnant, it was hard on me. I was sick all the time when I was expecting Dirk, and I almost died delivering him. Clan women didn't have that much trouble, but Dirk's head was so much bigger and harder than John Ayla's. Ayla had seen enough women into motherhood in the past few years to realize that her pregnancy and delivery of John Ayla was far more normal for women of the others than her birthing of Dirk had been. I don't know how I ever pushed him out, she thought, shaking her head. The heads of the others are smaller, and the bone is thinner and more flexible. Our legs and arms are longer, but those bones are thinner, too, Ayla said to herself, looking at her own limbs. All the bones of the others are thinner. Was Brookeval's grandmother sick during her pregnancy? Did she have a hard time delivering like I did? Is that what happened to her? Is that why she died? Because it was so hard on her? Even Joplea nearly died giving birth to Bokovan, and Etchazar is only half-clan. Is a baby of mixed spirits, a baby that's a mixture of the clan and the others, always hard on women of the others? Ayla was brought up short with a new thought. Could that be why those babies were originally called abominations? Because they sometimes made their mothers die? There are differences between the clan and the others. Maybe not enough to stop a baby from getting started, but enough to make it hard on the mother if she's one of the others and used to birthing babies with smaller heads. It might not be so hard on clan women. They're used to babies with big, long, hard heads and heavy brow ridges. It was probably easier for them to give birth to a mixed baby. I don't think it's always good for the babies, though, whether the mother is clan or others. Dirk was strong and healthy, even though I had a hard time, and so is Etchazar, and his mother was clan. Bokovan is healthy, but he's not quite the same. Etchazar, his father, was the first mixture, so he's like Brukaval, but still, Joplea almost died. She realized she was using the word father with ease. It was so logical, and she had understood the relationship for a long time. But Rydag was weak, and his mother was clan. She died after giving birth, but Nezi never said she had a hard time delivering. I don't think that's why she died. I think she'd been turned out of her clan and didn't want to live, especially since she must have thought her baby was deformed. Brukaval's mother was a first mixture, and her mother was one of the others. She was weak, so weak she died giving birth to him. Whether he wants to admit it or not, Brukaval knows what happened to his grandmother. That's why he was so quick to understand the implications of the gift of life at the meeting. I wonder if he ever thought that his mother's weakness was somehow caused by the mixture. I suppose I shouldn't blame Brukaval for hating the clan. He didn't have a mother to love him or to comfort him when people called him names because he looked a little different. It was hard for Dirk, too. He looked enough different from the clan that they thought he was deformed, and some of them didn't want to let him live, but at least he had people who loved him. I should have been more careful of Brukaval's feelings. I'm always so sure that I'm right, always blaming people for calling the clan flatheads and animals. I know they aren't, but most people don't know them like I do. It was my fault Brukaval ran away. I don't blame him for hating me. Ayla got up. She didn't want to sit inside any more. It was dim and gloomy in the windowless dwelling, and the lamp was guttering out, adding to the darkness. She wanted to get out, do something besides think about her shortcomings. As she stepped out of the dwelling and looked around, she was surprised to see Madraman approaching in a big hurry. When he saw her, he gave her such a malicious glare, she felt the tingle of icy needles prickling up her spine, raising the hairs on the back of her neck, and a cold shudder of ominous apprehension. Ayla watched him as he hurried on. "Something's different about him," she said to herself. Then she noticed he was not wearing his acolyte clothing, but the clothes he had on were strangely familiar. She wrinkled her brow in concentration. Then it came to her. Those are ninth cave patterns. But he's fifth cave. Why is he wearing ninth cave clothes? And where is he going in such a hurry? That look he gave me. Ayla shivered again at the thought, so full of hatred. Why should he hate me so much? And why wasn't he wearing his Oh. Suddenly it occurred to her. Zelindani must have told him he can't be an acolyte anymore. Is he blaming me? But he's the one who lied. Why should he blame me? It couldn't be because of Jandalar. He beat Madraman once, knocked his teeth out, but that was over Zelindani, not me. Could he hate me because I found his leather sack in the cave? Maybe he hates me because he will never be a Zelindani, and I just became one. That's two of them who hate me, Madraman and Brukaval, Ayla thought. Three if I count Larimar. He must hate me too. When he finally woke up, he said he didn't want to go back to the ninth cave when he felt good enough to leave the Zelindania Lodge, and they decided that he could. I'm glad the fifth cave said they would be willing to take him. I couldn't blame him if he never wanted to see me again. I deserve his hatred. It is my fault that Jandalar beat him so badly. Jandalar probably hates me now, too. Ayla was feeling so despondent she was beginning to think that everyone hated her. Ayla started walking faster, unmindful of where she was going. She looked up when she heard a soft whicker and found she was at the horse enclosure. She had been so busy the last few days she had hardly seen the horses, and when she heard the welcoming whinny of her dun-yellow mare, tears brought a familiar ache behind her eyes. She climbed over the fencing and hugged the sturdy neck of her old friend.
"Oh, Whinny, I'm so happy to see you," she said,
talking in the strange language she always used with the mare, the one she had made up so long ago in the valley, before Jandalar came and taught her his language.
"At least you still care about me," she said, as the tears overflowed. "You should probably hate me, too. I've been ignoring you so much, but I'm so glad you don't. You were always my friend, Whinny."
She said the name the way she had learned from the mare, a remarkably close reproduction of the sound of a horse whinny.
"When I didn't have anyone else, you were there. Maybe I should just go away with you. We could find the valley and live together like we used to."
As she was sobbing into the thickening fur of the yellow horse, the young gray mare and the brown stallion joined them. Gray tried to get her nose under Ayla's hand, while Racer bumped her back with his head to let her know he was there. Then he leaned against her, the way he had done so often before, keeping her between himself and his dam. Ayla hugged and stroked and scratched them all, then found a dried teasel to use as a currying brush and started to clean Winnie's coat. It had always been a relaxing activity for her to clean and care for the horses, and by the time she finished with Whinny and started on the impatient Racer, who had been nudging her for his share of her attention, her tears had dried, and she was feeling better. She was working on Gray when Joharan and Echazar came looking for her.
"Everyone was wondering where you were, Ayla," Echazar said,
smiling to see her standing in the middle of the three horses. It still amazed him to see her with the animals.
"I haven't spent much time with the horses lately, and their coats needed a good cleaning. They are already thickening up for winter," Ayla said.
"Proleva's been trying to keep the food warm for you, but she says it's drying out," Joharan said. "I think you should come and get something to eat."
"I'm almost through here. I've already brushed Whinny and Racer. I just have to finish up Gray. Then I probably should wash my hands,"
Ayla said, holding up her hand to show him her black palms, grimy with oily horse sweat and dirt.
"We'll wait,"
Joharan said. He had been given strict instructions not to return without her. By the time Ayla arrived, people were finishing with the meal and starting to leave the Lansadanyi camp for various afternoon activities. Ayla had been disappointed that Jandalar was not at the big feast, but no one could get him out of the phalange, short of picking him up and bodily carrying him. Once she was there, Ayla was glad she went. After she picked up the plate piled high with food that had been saved for her, she had been pleased to have a little more time to talk to Danuk and Druez and to get to know Aldenor a little better, although it appeared that she would have plenty of time for that. Falara and Aldenor were going to be mated at the late matrimonial, just before the summer meeting ended, and he was going to become Zelindanyi and a member of the Ninth Cave, much to Marthona's delight. Danuk and Druez promised to stop at his camp on their way back home and tell his people, but that wouldn't be until next summer. They were wintering with the Zelindanyi, and Willemar had promised to take them and a few others to see the great waters of the west soon after they returned to the Ninth Cave.
"Ayla, will you walk with me back to the Zelindania Lodge?" the first asked. "There are some things I'd like to talk over with you."
"Yes, of course, Zelindani," Ayla said.
Let me talk to Janela first.
She found her daughter with Marthona, and inevitably with Wolf.
Do you know Thona is my grandmother, not just my grandam?
Janela said when Ayla approached.
Yes, I do, Ayla said. Are you pleased to know that?
She reached to stroke the animal who was so excited to see her. Wolf had hardly left Janela for a moment since they arrived at the campsite, as though trying to make up for their long separation earlier. But he seemed overjoyed to see Ayla whenever she was near, anxiously seeking her affection and approval. He seemed most relaxed when they were both together with him, which usually was only at night. Although I've always felt that I was, it's nice to be acknowledged as the grandmother of the children of my sons, Marthona said. And though I've long thought of you as my daughter, Ayla, it pleases me to know that Falara has finally found an acceptable man to mate and may yet give me a grandchild before I walk the next world. She took Ayla's hand and looked at her. I want to thank you again for telling these men to come and get me. Smiling at Hartaman and some of the others who had carried her on a litter to the summer meeting and were often around the campsite since she arrived, she continued, I'm sure they were concerned about my health and meant well, but it takes a woman to understand that a mother needs to be with her daughter when she's contemplating her matrimonial.
Everyone was pleased to think you might feel well enough to come. You were greatly missed, Marthona,
Ayla said. Marthona avoided the subject of Jondalar's conspicuous absence and the probable reason for it, although it distressed her greatly to think that her son had once again lost control of himself and caused great harm to another person. She was also very concerned about Ayla. She had gotten to know the young woman quite well and knew how troubled she was, though she handled herself remarkably well in spite of her anguish.
Zelindani asked me to walk with her to the Zelindania Lodge, Ayla said. She said she wanted to talk about some things. Will you take Janela back with you, Marthona?
I'll be happy to. I've missed this little one, although Wolf is probably a better guardian than I am.
Are you coming back to sleep with me tonight, Mother?
Janela said with a worried look.
Of course. I'm just going to talk to Zelindani for a little while, Ayla said. Is Jondi going to sleep with us tonight?
I don't know, Janela. He's probably busy.
Why is he always so busy with those men in the Falage that he can't sleep with us?
The child asked. Sometimes men are just very busy, Marthona said, noticing that her mother was struggling to keep her control.
You go ahead with Zelindani, Ayla. We'll see you later. Come along, Janela. We should go and thank everyone for the wonderful feast. Then, if you like, you can ride with me on the litter when they carry me back.
Oh, could I?
Janela said. She thought it was particularly wonderful the way there were always a couple of young men nearby to carry Marthona wherever she wanted to go, especially if it was any distance. As Ayla and Zelindani walked toward the Zelindania Lodge together, discussing the meeting and the things that might be done to create a more positive mood about the changes the gift of knowledge would bring about, Zelindani thought that Ayla seemed quite despondent, though as usual she was covering it up well. When they reached the lodge, Zelindani started water heating for tea. They saw that Larimar had left the Zelindania Lodge already, and must have been moved to the Fifth Cave's camp. When the tea was ready, she led Ayla to a quiet area where there were a few stools and a low table. She considered trying to get Ayla to talk about what was bothering her, but changed her mind. The first thought she had a good idea what was troubling Ayla, though she had not heard Janela question her mother about Jondalar's absence and didn't know how much it added to her despair. The Danyar decided it might be better to talk about something else to get Ayla's mind off her worries and concerns.
I'm not sure if I heard you correctly at the time, Ayla.
I should say Zelandani of the Ninth Cave, but I thought you said you still had some of those roots that your clan Zelandani, what do you call him, Mogor, used in his special ceremonies. Is that right? The idea of them had intrigued the first, ever since Ayla mentioned them. Would they really still be good after all these years?
The clan in this region call him Mogor, but we always said Mogur. And yes, I still have some of the roots, and I'm sure they're good. They get stronger with age if stored properly. I know Isa often kept hers for the entire 7 years between clan gatherings, and sometimes longer, Ayla said.
What you said about them interests me, though I do understand they can be hazardous. It might be a valuable experience to try a small experiment.
I don't know, Ayla said. They are dangerous, and I'm not sure if I'd know how to do a small experiment. I only know one way to prepare them.
She felt nervous about the idea.
If you don't think it's appropriate to experiment, that's fine.
Zelandani didn't want to distress her further. She took a sip of her tea to give herself a few moments to think.
Do you still have the pouch of mixed herbs that we were going to experiment on together? The ones you got from that visiting Zelandani from the cave that's so far away?
Yes, I'll get them,
Ayla said, getting up to get the sack of medicinal herbs that she kept in her special place within the Zelandania Lodge. She thought of it as her Zelandania medicine bag, though it did not resemble her clan medicine bag. Some years before, she had made a new one in the clan style out of a whole otter skin, but it was in the lodge at the Ninth Cave's camp. Its distinctiveness gave it an unmistakable quality of something different. The one Ayla kept in the Zelandania Lodge was similar to the ones used by all the Danyers, a simple rawhide leather carrier, a smaller version of the one she used to carry meat. The decoration, however, was far from simple. Each of the medicine bags was unique, designed and made by each individual healer, bearing both required elements and others that were chosen by the user. Ayla brought hers back to the area where Zelandani was sipping tea while she waited. The young woman opened the leather packet and felt around inside. A frown creased her forehead. Finally, she emptied it out onto the small table between them and found the pouch she was looking for, but it was only half full.
"It looks like you have already experimented with that," Zelandani said.
"I don't understand," Ayla said. "I don't recall opening this pouch. How did it get used?"
She opened the container, poured a small amount in her palm, and sniffed.
"It smells like mint."
"If I recall correctly, the Zelandani who gave it to you said that the mint was put in as a way to identify this mixture. She doesn't keep mint in these kind of pouches, but in larger woven containers. So if it's in a pouch and smells like mint, she knows it is this mixture," Zelandani explained.
Ayla sat back and looked up at the ceiling with a deep frown, straining to remember. Suddenly, she sat up.
"I think I drank this the night I was watching the risings and settings, the night I was called. I thought it was mint tea."
Suddenly, she clasped her hand over her mouth.
"Oh, great mother, Zelandani, I might not have been called at all. It might have all been caused by this mixture,"
Ayla said, appalled. Zelandani leaned forward, patted Ayla's hand, and smiled.
"It's all right, Ayla. You don't need to be concerned about that. You were called, and you are Zelandani of the Ninth Cave. Many of the Zelandania have used similar herbs and mixtures to help them to find the spirit world. A person may find herself in a different place as a result of using them, but only if you are ready for it are you called. There is no question that your experience was a true calling, though I must admit I didn't expect it to happen to you quite so soon.
This mixture may have encouraged you to have it a little sooner than I anticipated, but that doesn't make it less meaningful.
Do you know what was in it?
Ayla asked. She did tell me the ingredients, but I don't know the proportions. Even though we like to share our knowledge, most Zelandania like to keep a few secrets. The one who was first smiled.
Why do you ask? I'm sure it must have been very strong,
Ayla said, then looked down at the cup of tea in her hands.
I was wondering if there was anything in it that could have caused me to miscarry.
Ayla, don't blame yourself, Zelandani said, leaning forward and taking her hand. I know it hurts to lose a baby, but you had no control over that. It was the sacrifice the mother demanded of you, perhaps because she had to bring you close enough to the next world to give you her message. There may be something in this mixture that would cause a miscarriage, but perhaps there was no other way. It may have been she who caused you to take this when you did, so that everything would happen as she wished.
I've never made a mistake like that with the medicines in my bag. I was careless, so careless I lost my baby,
Ayla said, as though she hadn't even heard the first. Because you don't make those kind of mistakes is all the more reason to believe it was her will. Whenever she calls someone to serve her, it is always unexpected, and the first time that one goes to the spirit world alone is especially dangerous. Many never find their way back. Some leave something behind, as you did. It is always dangerous, Ayla. Even if you've gone there many times, you never know if this is the time that you will not find your way back. Ayla was quietly sobbing, the tears glistening on her cheeks.
It's good that you're letting go. You've held in for too long, and you need to grieve for that baby, the Danyer said.
She got up, took both cups, and went to the back where the bandaging skins were stored. When she returned, she poured more tea.
Here,
she said, handing her the soft animal hide, and put the tea on the table. Ayla wiped her eyes and her nose, took a deep breath to settle herself, then took a sip of the warmish tea, struggling to get herself under control again. It was more than losing the baby that had caused her tears, although that had been the catalyst. She couldn't seem to do anything right. Jondalar had stopped loving her, people hated her, and she had been so careless that she lost her baby. She had heard Zelandani's words, but she didn't fully comprehend, and it didn't change how she felt. Perhaps now you can understand why I'm so interested in those roots you talk about, the first said, when it seemed that Ayla was feeling better. If the experience can be carefully watched and controlled, we may have another helpful way to reach the next world when we need to, like this mixture in the pouch, and some other herbs we sometimes use. Ayla didn't hear her at first. When Zelandani's words finally reached her, she recalled that she had never wanted to experiment with those roots again. Though the Mogur had been able to control the effects of the powerful substance, she was sure she never would be capable of it. She believed only a clan mind with its unique differences and the clan memories could control it. She didn't think anyone born to the others could ever control the black void, no matter how well they were watched. She knew that the first was fascinated. Mahmut had been intrigued, too, about the special plants used only by the Mogurs of the clan. But after their dangerous experience together, Mahmut had said he would never use them again. He told her he was afraid he would lose his spirit in that paralyzing black void and had warned her against them. Reliving the terrifying journey to that menacing, unknown place when she was deep in the cave and vividly recalling it during her initiation made the memory too disturbingly fresh, and she knew that even her unnerving recollection was only a faint shadow of the real experience. Yet in the black despair of her present state of mind, she wasn't thinking clearly. She should have had time to regain her balance, but too much had happened too fast. Her ordeal in the cave when she was called, including the miscarriage, had weakened her both physically and emotionally. The pain and the jealousy and the disappointment of finding Jandalar with another woman were intensified by her experience in the cave and by her loss. She had been looking forward to the knowing touch of his hands and the closeness of his body, to the thought of replacing the baby she had lost, to the healing comfort of his love. Instead, she found him with another woman, and not just any woman, the woman who had viciously and knowingly tried to hurt her before. Under normal circumstances, she might have been able to take his indiscretion in stride, especially if it had been with someone else. She might not have been happy about it. They had been too close. But she understood the customs. They were not so different from those of the men of the clan, who could choose whatever woman they wanted. She knew how jealous Jandalar had been about her and Rainik when they lived with the Mamutoi, even though she didn't know what was causing the barely controlled violence of his reaction. Rainik had told her to come with him, and she was raised by the clan. She hadn't learned yet that among the others, she had the right to say no. When they finally resolved the problem and she left with Jandalar back to his home, she had decided in her own mind that she would never give him cause to be jealous of her again. She never chose anyone else, even though she knew it would have been acceptable, and to her knowledge, he never did either. He certainly never did openly, as the other men did. When she was confronted with the fact that he not only had chosen someone else, but that he had been choosing that particular woman in secret for a long time, she felt utterly betrayed. But Jandalar had not meant to betray her. He wanted to keep her from finding out so she wouldn't be hurt. He knew she never chose anyone else, and at a certain level, he even knew why. Though he would have struggled to control it, he knew how jealous he would have been if she had chosen someone else. He did not want her to experience the intensity of pain that he would have felt. When she found them together, he was beside himself. He simply didn't know what to do. He had never learned. Jandalar was born to grow into a 6-foot-6-inch-tall, well-formed, incredibly handsome man, with an unconscious charisma enhanced by a vividly intense shade of blue eyes. His natural intelligence, innate manual dexterity, and intrinsic mechanical skill were discovered early, and he was encouraged to apply it in many areas until he discovered his love for napping flint and making tools. But his powerful feelings were also stronger than most, far too intense, and his mother and those who cared about him struggled to teach him to keep them under control. Even as a child, he wanted too much, cared too much, felt too much. He could be overcome with compassion, yearn with desire, rage with hate, or burn with love. He was given too much, too many gifts, and few understood what a burden that could be. When he was a young man, Jandalar had been taught how to please a woman, but that was a normal practice of his culture. It was something all young men were taught. The fact that he'd learned it so well was partly because he had been taught so well, and partly the result of his own natural inclination. He discovered young that he loved pleasing women, but he never had to learn how to interest a woman. Unlike most men, he never had to find ways to make a woman notice him. He couldn't help but be noticed. He sought ways to get away occasionally. He never had to think about how to meet a woman. Women went out of their way to meet him. Some threw themselves at him. He never had to entice a woman to spend her time with him. Women couldn't get enough of him. And he never had to learn how to handle loss, or a woman's anger, or his own blundering mistakes. No one imagined that a man with his obvious gifts wouldn't know how.
Jandalar's reaction when something didn't go right was to withdraw, try to keep his feelings under control, and hope that somehow it would sort itself out. He hoped that he would be forgiven, or his mistakes overlooked, and usually that was what happened. He didn't know what to do when Ayla saw him with Morona, and Ayla wasn't any more adept at handling those kinds of situations. From the time she was first found by the clan as a 5-year, she had struggled to fit in, to make herself acceptable, so they would not turn her out. The clan didn't cry emotional tears, and hers disturbed them, so she learned to hold them back. The clan didn't display anger or pain or other strong emotions. It was not considered proper. So she learned not to show hers. To be a good clan woman, she learned what was expected of her and tried to behave the way she was expected to behave. She had tried to do the same with the Zelindanyi. But now she was at a loss. It seemed obvious to her that she had not learned how to be a good Zelindanyi woman. People were upset with her. Some people hated her. And Jandalar didn't love her. He had been ignoring her, and she had tried to provoke him to respond to her, but his brutal attack on Larimar was completely unexpected, and she felt beyond all doubt that it was entirely her fault. She had seen his compassion and his love, and had seen him control his strong feelings when they were living with the Mamutoi. She thought she knew him. Now she was convinced she didn't know him at all. She had been trying to maintain a semblance of normality by sheer force of will, but she was tired from lying awake too many nights, too full of worry, pain, and anger to sleep, and what she needed desperately was calm surroundings and rest. Perhaps Zelindani had been a little too interested in learning about the clan root, or she might have been more perceptive, but Ayla had always been a case apart. They didn't have enough common points of reference. Their backgrounds were far too different. Just when she thought she really understood the young woman, she'd find out that what she thought was true about Ayla was not.
"I don't want to make it a big issue if you really feel we shouldn't, Ayla, but if you could tell me something about how to prepare this root, perhaps we can work out a small experiment, just to see if it might be useful. It would be just for the Zelindania, of course. What do you think?"
Zelindani said. In Ayla's troubled state, even the terrifying black void struck her as a restful place, a place to get away from all the turmoil around her. And if she didn't come back, what difference would it make? Jandalar didn't love her anymore. She would miss her daughter. Ayla felt a tight knot grip her stomach, then thought, Janela would probably be better off without her. The child was missing Jandalar. If she wasn't there, he would come back and take care of her again. And there were so many people who loved her. She would be well cared for.
"It's not that complicated, Zelindani," Ayla said. "Essentially, the roots are chewed to a mash and spit into a bowl of water. But they are hard to chew, and it takes a long time. And the one who is preparing it is not supposed to swallow any of the juice. It could be that it's a necessary ingredient, the juice that accumulates in the mouth," Ayla said.
"That's all? It seems to me if you just use a small amount, like one would test anything new, it shouldn't be that dangerous," Zelindani said.
"There are some clan rituals involved. The medicine woman who prepares the root for the Mogurs is supposed to purify herself first, bathe in a river using soap root, and she is not supposed to wear clothing. Issa told me that was so the woman would be unsullied and open, with nothing hidden, so that she would not contaminate the holy men, the Mogurs. The Mogur, Kreb, painted my body with red and black colors, mostly circles around the female parts, to isolate them, I think," Ayla said. "It is a very sacred ceremony to the clan."
"We could use the new cave you found. It's a very sacred place," and private. This would be a good use for it, the first said. Anything else?
No, except when I tried the route with Mahmud, he made sure that the people of the lion camp kept chanting, so we would have something to hold on to, something that would keep us tethered to this world and help us find our way back.
She hesitated, looked down at the empty cup still in her hands, and added softly,
I'm not sure how, but Mahmud said Jandalar may have helped bring us back.
We will make sure all the Zelandania are there. They are very good at sustained chanting. Does it make any difference what is chanted? The first asked.
I don't think so. Just something familiar, Ayla said.
When should we plan to do it? Zelandani asked, more excited than she thought she would be.
I don't think it matters.
Tomorrow morning, as soon as you can get everything ready. Ayla shrugged as if she didn't care. At that moment, she didn't.
It's as good a time as any, I suppose, she said.
Chapter 39 Jandalar was filled with as much anxiety and despair as Ayla. He had tried to avoid everyone as much as possible since the big ceremony where everyone was told about men and why they were created. He recalled parts of that night only vaguely. He did remember smashing Larimar in the face over and over again, and he couldn't erase from his mind the picture of that man moving up and down on top of Ayla. When he woke up the next day, his head was pounding. He was still somewhat dizzy and very nauseous. He couldn't remember ever being so sick the next day, and wondered what was in the drinks he consumed. Danuk was there, and he thought he ought to feel grateful to him, but he didn't know why. He asked Danuk questions, trying to fill in the blanks. As Jandalar learned what he had done, he started to recall what had happened, and was appalled and full of remorse and shame. He had never much liked Larimar, but nothing he had ever done could be as bad as what Jandalar had done to him. He was so filled with self-hatred, he could not think of anything else. He was sure everyone felt the same way about him, and he was convinced that Ayla could not possibly love him any more. How could anyone love someone so despicable? Part of him wanted to leave everything behind and just go as far away as he could get, but something held him back. He told himself he had to face his punishment, at least find out what it would be and somehow make amends. But it was more that things felt unfinished, and he couldn't go leaving everything so unresolved. And deep inside, he wasn't sure he could simply walk away from Ayla and John Ayla. He couldn't bear the thought of never seeing them again, even if only from a distance. His mind became a confusion of pain, guilt, and desperation. He could think of nothing he might do to make his life right again, and every time he saw anyone, he was sure they were looking at him with the same disgust and loathing that he felt about himself. Part of his self-recrimination stemmed from the fact that as despicably as he'd behaved, and as ashamed as he was, every time he closed his eyes to try to sleep at night, he would see Larimar on top of Ayla and feel the same rage and frustration he'd felt then. He knew in his heart that under the same circumstances he would do it again. Jandalar's mind dwelled on his problems constantly. He could hardly think of anything else. It was an incessant itch, like continually picking on the scab of a minor cut, never giving it a chance to heal, making it worse and worse until it became a running infection. He tried to get away from people as often as he could, and began taking long walks, usually beside the bank of the river, most often upstream. Each time he went, he'd walk a little farther, stay a little longer, but he always reached a point where he could not go on and would have to turn around and walk back. Occasionally he would get racer and instead of walking along the river, would ride out across the open grassland. He resisted taking his horse too often, because it was then that he was most tempted to keep on going. But this day, he wanted to ride out and put some distance between himself and the camp. As soon as she was fully awake, Ayla got up and went to the river. She hadn't slept well. At first, she was too edgy and restless to fall asleep, and then she was awakened by dreams that she couldn't quite remember, but that left her uneasy. She thought about what she needed to do to make the clan ceremony as close to correct as possible. While she looked for soap root to purify herself, she also kept an eye out for a nodule of flint or even a leftover piece of reasonable size. She wanted to make a cutting tool in the clan way that she could use to cut off a piece of leather to make a clan amulet. When she came to the mouth of the small stream as it emptied into the river, she turned to follow it instead. She had to walk upstream some distance before she found a few soap root plants in the woods behind the camp of the ninth cave. It was late in the season, and most had been picked, and then the variety she found wasn't the same plant that the clan used, and she had wanted the ritual to be right. Although, since she was a woman, it would never be a clan ceremony anyway. Only men of the clan consumed the roots. The woman's job was only to prepare them. As she stooped to pull the soap roots out, she thought she caught a glimpse of Jandalar in the woods, walking alongside the small stream. But when she stood up, she didn't see him and wondered if it was her imagination. The stallion was glad to see Jandalar. The other horses were, too, but he didn't want to take them. He was in the mood for a long run alone. When they reached the open plains, Jandalar urged the horse into a thundering gallop across the land. Racer seemed just as eager to live up to his name. Jandalar wasn't paying much attention to where they were going or where they were. Suddenly, he was literally jerked out of his moody meditation when he heard a loud, belligerent neigh, the sound of hoofs, and felt his mount begin to rear. They were in the middle of a herd of horses. It was only his years of riding and quick reflexes that enabled him to keep his seat. He lunged forward and grabbed a handful of the stand-up mane of the step horse and held on, struggling to calm the stallion and get him back under control. Racer was a healthy stallion in his prime, though he'd never had the experience of living in the auxiliary male herd that stayed near the fringes of a primary herd of females and young, keeping the herd stallion constantly on guard and ready to defend his own, or of the play fighting with other young males as he was growing up. Yet he was instinctively ready to challenge the herd male. Jandalar's first thought was to get his horse as far away from the herd as possible, as fast as he could. But it was all he could do to turn the stallion around and head back toward the campsite. When Racer settled down and they were finally heading steadily back, Jandalar began to wonder if it was fair to keep the virile stallion away from other horses, and for the first time, he seriously contemplated the idea of letting him go. He wasn't ready to give him up yet, but he began to rethink taking long rides alone on the brown stallion. On the way back, he found himself moodily introspective again. He remembered the day of the big meeting and watching Ayla sitting stiffly while Brukhaval reviled her. He had ached to comfort her, to force Brukhaval to stop, to tell him he was wrong. He had completely understood everything Zelandani said. He'd heard most of it over the years from Ayla, and he was more ready than most to accept it. The thing that was new to him was the name given to the relationship, Far Mother, shortened to Father. And he thought about Zelandani's final words, that the men would name the boys. Fathers would name their sons. He said the word over to himself. Father. He was a father.
He was John Ayla's father. He wasn't fit to be John Ayla's father. It would shame her to name him her father. He had nearly killed a man with his fists. If it hadn't been for Danuk, he would have. Ayla had lost a baby when she was alone in the deep passages of Fountain Rock's cave, and he wasn't there to help her. What if the child she had lost was a boy? If she hadn't lost it, and it was a boy, would he have been the one to name him? What would it be like to decide on a name for a child? What did it matter? He would never be able to name a child. He would never have any more children. He had lost his mate. He would have to leave his hearth. After Zelandani had closed the meeting, he had avoided the conversations that everyone was having and had hurried back to the Falage so he wouldn't have to see Ayla or John Ayla. He was still feeling the same when the rest of the Falage started walking towards the Lansadanyi camp for the big feast the next day. But after everyone had been gone for some time, Jondalar couldn't seem to stop himself from dwelling on all his wrongs. Finally, he couldn't stand it inside the lodge, with his mind going over and over the same things, blaming himself, berating himself, scourging himself. He went out and headed for the river to take another long walk. Since his near encounter with the stallion when they ran into a herd of mares, Racer seemed more excitable, and Jondalar decided not to ride him. As he started walking upstream, he was surprised to see that Wolf had caught up with him. Jondalar was glad to see the carnivore and stopped to greet him, catching the great head by his ruff that was growing thicker now and more luxurious.
"Wolf, what brings you here? Are you tired of all the noise and commotion, too? Well, you're welcome to join me," he said with enthusiasm. The animal responded with a low growl of pleasure. Wolf had been so involved with John Ayla, after being away from her for so long, and with Ayla, who had been his primary focus since the day she pulled the frightened 4-week-old pup from his cold and lonely den, that he hadn't spent much time with the third human he considered to be an essential member of his pack. On the way back to the camp of the Ninth Cave, after the meal he'd been given, he saw Jondalar heading towards the river and ran after the man, ahead of John Ayla. He turned back to look at her and whined.
"Go ahead, Wolf," the child said, signaling him on. "Go with Jondalar."
She had seen the man's great unhappiness, and she was more than aware that her mother was just as sad, for all that she tried not to show it. She didn't know exactly what, but the child knew something was terribly wrong, and it gave her a fearful knot in the pit of her stomach. More than anything, she wanted her family back together, and that included her Thona and Weemar and Wolf and the horses, too. "Maybe Jondi needs to see you, Wolf, and be with you like I did," John Ayla thought. Ayla had been thinking about Jondalar, or more precisely, about using the pool in the small river for her ceremonial bath, and that made her think of Jondalar. She wanted the quiet and privacy of the secluded place for the purification cleansing, but she hadn't been able to go back since she found Jondalar there with Morona. She knew there was flint in that area. Jondalar had found some, but she didn't see any and didn't think she would have time to look farther afield. She knew Jondalar always had a few good hunks of flint around, but she didn't even consider asking him. He wasn't talking to her these days. She would just have to make do with a Zelandanyi knife and all to cut the hide and to pierce holes around the edge for the drawstring, even if it was another deviation from clan custom. She found a flattish rock, carried it closer to the pool in the small river, and then, with another rounder stone, she pounded the foamy saponifying ingredients from the soap roots on it, mixed with a little water. Then she stepped into the quiet backwater inside a curve at the edge of the pool and began to smooth the slippery foam on her body.
The bottom dropped off quickly as she moved out from the bank to rinse. She ducked her head under, swam a few strokes, then returned to wash her hair. As Ayla bathed in the pool, she thought about the clan. She remembered her childhood with Brun's clan as peaceful and safe, with Isa and Kreb there to love her and take care of her. Everyone knew from the time they were born what was expected of them, and there was no allowance for deviation. Roles were clearly defined. Everyone knew where they fit, knew their rank, knew their jobs, knew their place. Life was stable and secure. They didn't have to worry about new ideas changing things. Why was she the one who had to bring changes that affected everyone, that some would hate her for? Looking back, her life with the clan seemed so reassuring, she wondered why she had struggled so hard against the restrictions. The ordered life of the clan appealed to her now. There was a comforting security to a strictly regulated life. Yet she was glad she had taught herself to hunt, though it was against clan traditions. She was a woman, and women of the clan did not hunt. But if she hadn't known how, she wouldn't be alive now, even if she almost died for it after they found out. The first time she was cursed, when Brun expelled her from the clan, he limited the time to only one moon. It was the beginning of winter, and they all expected her to die, but the hunting she was cursed for had saved her life from the curse. Maybe I should have died then, she thought. She had defied the way of the clan again when she ran away with Dirk, but she couldn't let them expose her newborn son to the mercy of the elements and carnivores just because they thought he was deformed. Brun had spared them, though Braud objected. He had never made her life easy. When he became leader and cursed her, it was forever and for no good reason, and that time she was finally forced to leave the clan. Hunting saved her then, too. She would never have survived in the valley if she wasn't a hunter, and if she hadn't known that she could live alone if she had to. Ayla was still thinking about the clan and how to handle the rituals associated with the roots properly when she returned to the camp. She saw Janayla sitting with Proliva and Marthona. They waved and beckoned to her. "Come have something to eat," Proliva said. Wolf had grown tired of walking with the melancholy man, who did nothing but shuffle along, and came back to find Janayla. He was on the other side of the fire, gnawing a bone, and looked up. Ayla walked in their direction. She gave her daughter a hug, then held her off and looked at her with a strange sadness, and hugged her again, almost too hard.
"Your hair is wet, Mother,"
Janayla said, squirming out of the way.
"I just washed it,"
Ayla said, petting the large wolf who had come to greet her. She took the handsome head between her hands, looked deeply into his eyes, then hugged him with fervor. When she stood up, the wolf looked up at her with anticipation. She patted the front of her shoulder. He jumped up, steadied himself with his paws on her shoulders, licked her neck and face, then took her jaw gently in his teeth and held it. When he let go, she returned the wolf signal of pack membership, taking his muzzle in her teeth for a moment. She hadn't done that for a while, and Ayla thought he seemed pleased. Proliva let out the breath she'd been holding when Wolf dropped down. That particular bit of wolfish behavior from Ayla was disturbing, no matter how many times she saw it. Watching the woman exposing her neck to the teeth of the huge wolf always unnerved her and made her realize that the friendly, well-behaved animal was a powerful wolf who could easily kill any one of the humans he mingled with so freely. After she caught her breath and settled her apprehensions, Proliva commented,
"Help yourself, Ayla. There's plenty. This morning's meal was easy to make. There was a lot left over from yesterday's feast. I'm glad we decided to make a meal together with the Lanzadani. I liked working with Jerrica and Joplea and several of the other women. I feel as though I know them better now.
Ayla felt a pang of regret. She wished she hadn't been so busy with the Zelandania. She would have liked to help with the feast. Working together was a good way to get to know people better. Being wrapped up in her own problems didn't help either. She could have gotten there earlier, she thought, as she picked up one of the extra cups that were set out for those who forgot their own and dipped a cup of chamomile tea from the large, curved wooden cooking box. Tea was always the first thing made in the morning.
The aurochs is particularly good and juicy, Ayla. They've started to put on their winter fat, and Proliva just reheated it. You should try some, Marthona urged, noticing that she wasn't taking any food. Food holders are over there. She indicated a stack of odd-sized but generally flat pieces of wood, bone, and ivory that were used as plates. Trees that had been felled and broken for firewood often produced large splinters that could be quickly trimmed and smoothed into plates and dishes. Shoulder and pelvic bones from various deer, bison, and aurochs were roughly shaped to a reasonable size for the same purpose. The tusks of mammoths could be chipped off, much like flint, but making much larger flakes that were used for plates as well. Mammoth ivory could even be pre-shaped by cutting a circular groove first with a Burin chisel, then using a solid end piece of antler or horn with the pointed tip held at just the right angle in the groove of the circle, and with practice and a bit of luck, a blow from a hammerstone on the back of it would detach an ivory flake with the pre-cut shape. But that much work was usually done only for objects meant to be given as gifts or for other special purposes. Such pre-shaped flakes of ivory with smooth, slightly rounded outside surfaces could be used for more than dishes. Decorative images could be etched on them.
Thank you, Marthona, but I have to get some things and go to see Zelandani, Ayla said.
Suddenly she stopped and hunkered down in front of the older woman, who was sitting on a small stool woven together out of reeds, cattail leaves, and flexible branches.
I really do want to thank you for being so kind to me since the first day I arrived. I don't remember my own mother, only Issa, the clan woman who raised me, but I like to think that my real mother would have been like you.
I think of you as a daughter, Ayla, Marthona said, more moved than she would have expected. My son was lucky to find you.
Then she shook her head slightly.
Sometimes I wish he were more like you.
Ayla hugged her, then turned to Proliva.
Thank you too, Proliva. You've been such a good friend to me, and I appreciate more than I can say the way you've taken care of John Ayla when I had to stay back at the Ninth Cave, and when I've been busy here.
She hugged Proliva, too.
I wish Folara was here, but I know she's busy with the preparations for her matrimonial. I think Aldenar is a good man. I'm so happy for her.
I have to go now, she said suddenly, hugged her daughter again, then hurried to the dwelling, misty-eyed with the tears she was holding back.
I wonder what that was all about, Proliva said.
If I didn't know better, I'd think she almost sounded like she was saying goodbye, Marthona said.
Is Mother going someplace, Thona?
John Ayla asked. I don't think so. At least no one has said anything to me. Ayla stayed in the summer dwelling for a while, making preparations. First, she cut out a roughly circular shape from the belly of the skin of the red deer she had brought with her to the summer meeting. She had found the soft buckskin hide the day before, folded up on her sleeping roll. When she asked John Ayla who cured the deer skin, she was told everybody did. Cordage, fibrous rope, twine, thread, tough sinew and strips of leather thong in various sizes were always useful and easy to make without having to think about it
once the techniques were learned. Most people